Robin Miller, another week in IndyCar news. We've got a lot of news to talk about, but we also have a little race that went down in Texas that, man, you talk about the grumpy, crashy 600 at Texas Motor Speedway. Read some comments from fans, some. Most were outraged, upset, pointing fingers, thinking Tony Kanaan should retire. Read a few others where folks said that was the most exciting thing they'd ever seen. It was awesome. It was the best. More of that. I don't know if those folks maybe understand the cost that these types of races can have, not just monetarily, but in health or the potential of how these things, when they go wrong, they go really wrong and get really sad. But you wrote about it. You tallied up the numbers. You spoke with everybody. I've spoken with a lot of people as well. What have you taken out of Texas here? Couple days since, man, seems like a real unhappy experience for more than we're used to.
Well, all the people that were there, they were still standing and cheering at the end. I mean, they were greatly entertained, and I don't think any fan wants to see somebody gets hurt, but it was an exciting, wheel to wheel crashes, a little bit of everything, just like Indy had. I guess the thing that in the mailbag, it was running like 3-1 that people, they liked it. It's just that I think I underestimated the crash damage. I think it's closer to 2.4 million than 1.8, because I talked to a couple more team managers on Monday and Tuesday after I'd written the story. But just running through the garage after the race, it was pretty much looked like a disaster, which it was. But I guess we have to also remember it's been since 2011 we've ever had a multiple crash, and they've done some really good, in the last few years at Texas, they've done a really good job of almost kind of protecting each other and racing hard. I mean, last year with Hinch and TK and Pagano and Rahal, they came as close as you can, that was as close a race as you're ever going to get and as close a finish as you're ever going to get. So they made it. Some guys, I think some of the veterans said, we just needed to test more because the tire was an unknown and we didn't have enough time and it was too much like pack racing. You were in the IRL when it was four rows of two around that place, but it wasn't, there were times when there was a couple rows, but there was a lot more two wide, three wide, diving in and out. It was exactly what Texas, I think, we had the biggest NBC Sports Network audience that we've ever had at Texas, so I think people must have liked it.
I think Will Power, who really truly was the class of the field, not only pace and performance-wise, but just, very smart about how he drove, led the majority of the thing. I think Will had a great comment, might have been to you after the race, about how, one of the other things to consider is there are a lot of drivers who are participating in their very first oval pack race. A lot of the folks who did it were familiar with it, kind of knew how to behave or what not to do to trigger a 29-car pileup. It's been a while since the IRL / IndyCar did this on a regular basis, and there were still some smash-ups back then, but for the most part, there was a bit of a training element to it, a practice element, that when you did have one, folks knew where to fall in, knew how to act to get to the finish line. I think Power's understanding that, I don't know if everybody really knew what they were in the midst of until they were in it. And then we saw some folks, a lot of them who'd never done it, but then, even one who had, like TK, it was a bit messy. Educational, I hope, but obviously a bit messy.
Gabby Chavez did a hell of a job, finished fifth, and I was talking to him after the race, and he's like, man, that was so intense. I've never been involved in something like that. And I think that's the thing. Ed Jones said it was kind of fun, but boy, it was intense. And I think if you're allowed to, if you're not just stuck together and can't get away, And they weren't completely stuck together. It just wasn't a classic pack race. I mean, it was pack racing sprinkled into it, no doubt about it. And you could sit on somebody's right rear tire, but I mean, Hinch did the same thing Will did last year, led 188 laps, and I think pretty much stayed on the bottom because that's the shortest way around, the smartest way around. So I don't know. I think it's interesting to me that the Penske boys were so strong in the race because Honda just smoked them in qualifying. Honda had the fastest 8 times speeds, but before the race, Graham Rahal said, "I think our biggest competition is going to be Penske." I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah, I was running with them on Friday night," and he goes, "I think they've really got good race cars," and it turned out to be his prophecy was true.
Part of the pack racing thing, and totally agree, it wasn't a case where cars were 100% glued and could not move. There were opportunities, and that's where I actually think the real problem came in, Robin, is with what we ended up having, the aero spec matched with the new track surface, matched with Firestone tires, which they thought were going to last longer than they did and be better than they were, but ended up blistering very badly on many cars. With this thing that we found happening, you look and realize that drivers had just enough ability to pull off a pass that to get there, to do it, it wasn't going to come easy. They weren't just going to slingshot past someone, take the position. Desperation was involved in a lot of moves. A lot of aggression was needed to make a pass, try a pass. Tristan Vautier, who, I mean, the kid was the surprise of the event, drove to the front, led quite a bit, or led on multiple occasions, I should say. I mean, we absolutely applaud what he was able to do. If you go back and rewind the tape, though, you'll also see a lot of times where you're covering your eyes going, "Jesus, kid, like, take it easy." I'm not talking on his own apexing. I'm talking about cutting and diving and slashing and all these little instances where hyper-aggression and desperation really became the fuel that was needed by way too many drivers to try and pull off a pass. So, you know, you see that on a road course, someone gets desperate, chucks a thing down the inside of someone at the apex, they both crash, they nerf into the tire wall, they get out and yell at each other, but it's no big deal. You're doing this at 215 miles an hour, and you have 3-car pileups, 8-car pileups. Just, I know that there were drivers, Robin, that warned IndyCar before the race, "Hey, this is going to be like a pack race. You know, there are going to be big blockades we can't get around, so you're going to see folks really, you know, getting way too amped up." And it did. That prophecy came true for the most part. I don't know how we solve this, though. I mean, do you lay this on IndyCar's lap? Do you lay this on Firestone? I don't know. Do you lay it on anyone's?
No, I just think you have to maybe, you know, another test day or two maybe would have helped with everybody there. I don't think everybody was there, and I don't know how much they ran, but even the driver said after that, it'll probably be a pack race. And, you know, I think the desperation, I think the only thing that really had people scratching their head was there's no reason to be desperate with 100 laps to go. And I think that was probably the biggest rub, was that, you know, save it for the last 10 laps if you're going to go berserk and try everything. I mean, don't do it with 100 laps to go. My God, the whole pack was within, the whole field was within 3 seconds of each other most of the night. So, yeah, there was a lot of restarts, and that breeds crashes, and that breeds crazy driving, but I don't know. I think here we are on Thursday, and people are still writing and talking about it, and nobody got hurt, thankfully. And yes, you want to make sure that maybe the new aero kit will maybe allow guys, maybe the Hanford device. I mean, I remember arguing with Alex Zanardi. He hated the Hanford device. He got beat at Michigan by Greg Moore on the last lap, and he goes, "This isn't racing. This is artificial racing. Guy can blow by anytime you want." It was fabulous for the fans. It was great for the TV audience, and I think Adam Saul kept track of the passes. It was 240 some passes that didn't necessarily register at the start finish line, but it was unbelievable how many people were passed during the race. And yeah, I guess artificial is one way to look at it, but maybe this new aero kit with the downforce switch and everything, maybe it makes it easier for people to slingshot people and draft like they do at Indy, maybe instead of getting stuck on the outside or just hanging there or trying to make that outside groove work. So you know, it's only once a year. And it was always like when we left Michigan in the cart days, I was always happy when there was, only, you know, and then Fontana came along. It didn't seem to be quite as wild. And then, you know, you just kind of take a deep breath and go, well, okay, they made it through that. It was, you know, you get paid to take chances, and racing's supposed to be dangerous. Not crazy, but dangerous, because that's why it's part of the attraction. Some guy wrote, well, Mel, you said dangerous part of it. That's not why I watch. I'm not saying that's why you watch. I'm just saying that the fact that this is there's not that many guys that either want to do it or can do it at those speeds and at those close proximities is part of IndyCar's, but it's part of their attraction.
And that's why you respect it as well. That's why these oval races, as crazy as they can be, also earn our absolute respect, because Texas in particular, Texas is the craziest event of the year, and it has been for quite some time. We love it when we have an Indy 500 like the one that just went down and the year before. I mean, so there are other ovals that are great, but Texas every year is usually the, oh my God, I need to sit down and can catch my breath type event. Had a good conversation with Dale Coyne Racing engineer Craig Hampson on Monday or Tuesday, and they obviously got beaten the heck up with two cars that were tore up pretty good in Vautier and Jones. Obviously already destroyed two chassis this year, one at Phoenix, another one at Indianapolis. All their big damage have come on ovals. Texas, I know, was really that was hard for them to swallow, knowing that neither of their guys were at fault. And Craig mentioned something that I know you and I discussed as well privately. He said, this is our heritage, right? IndyCar needs ovals. Anyone who says IndyCar doesn't need ovals, please go follow another sport, because you truly have no clue. This is our heritage, though, oval racing, and we need to keep doing it. But IndyCar needs to make sure its teams can afford to do it. And that's another thing that I thought Texas really highlighted in your great article about the costs, which, you know, keep going up as teams find more things they need to repair from Texas. But his whole point was this: how many of the teams are paying for this themselves in some way? You look at the coin cars. They aren't exactly overflowing with sponsorship stickers. You look at the Ganassi cars, right? We know that Tony Kanaan's sponsored by NTT Data. Their base is in Texas, so it was great that Scott Dixon's car had NTT Data, but it didn't have Camping World. It didn't have some other big brands, so, you know, was that a gimme? I don't know. You know, was it just done to make NTT super happy at the home race? Don't know. You know, just throwing that out there. You look at the Andretti cars. Alexander Rossi's been sponsored for three races now by shopandretti.com. I mean, buy stuff at shopandretti.com, folks. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but is that a sponsor? Is Michael writing a check to get that on the side of his own car? I don't think so. Sato's car, and good on them, promoted the Check at Andretti colon awareness initiative. So that's a good thing as well. But we're not talking about big brands on a lot of these cars. Gabby Chavez, awesome team owner in Mike Harding. Who's their sponsor? Harding Racing. There's too many of those teams that the person whose name is on the door at the shop is the one who's writing a check or all the checks or most of the checks to get this stuff done. And when you go to a race like Texas, where there is this big kind of configuration mismatch between downforce, tire life, grip, blah, 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 folks are having to just fall over one another to make a pass happen. Half the field's thrown into the wall. Mark Miles, Jay Fry didn't wake up Sunday morning, call the team owners and said, all right, tell us where to wire the money to pay for all this damage. Just, I think Craig's point was, we need to do this. It's our heritage. Let's not stop, but let's think about how we go to these races so maybe we aren't falling over each other as much, and these team owners who are already financially stressed aren't sitting here at the halfway point going, can I make it? Am I going to have to skip the last couple races because I've burned up so much money crashing on all these ovals? You think he has a point, Robin? And if so, you know, is there anything IndyCar can do to help?
Look, what do we got? Do we have seven or eight owners in this series? Seven or eight owners. I think it's 7, and you've got very little sponsorship. The TV ratings aren't very good. It's very tough to find a sponsor. Verizon puts in whatever they put in, but, you know, I don't know that any of that goes to the teams. Mark Miles wants to get a couple foreign races because he knows at least maybe they could get some money out of it, which is the teams desperately need money, and where does it come from? And to Craig's point, and to Mike Cannon and I were sitting on the plane talking about the same thing on the way home, right now, nobody can afford almost to run any kind of race, let alone an oval, if you have a big crash. So how do you get more money? And I think Eddie Gossage was mad at me because I wrote something about what the purse was, 30, 20, 15, and he said, you know more about that. You're just hiding it. Well, I didn't know more about it. And I guess the promoters do put in some money towards the year-end point fund that the top 12 get money. But my point being is, whatever the purse is, even with what percentage is put into it by the promoters, it's not nearly enough. Not to cover what, I mean, everybody lost money Saturday night, including Roger Penske, who won the race and destroyed 2 cars. I mean, you can't, and, you know, you just don't, to justify, this is why there's no owners. Nobody can afford to do this. And there's nothing that's enticing to come run. I mean, you can't, you know, if you run the Indy 500 and you're not a Leader Circle guy, you're going to make $203,000 or some crazy figure like that that pays, half of it goes to your tire bill for the month of May. So IndyCar's biggest problem is what it's always been. And this, you know, Mark Miles and Jay, they inherited this. This wasn't something they did. It's been this way for a long time. It's just that there has to be at some point, you got to figure out how to make this thing more affordable and get some money to the teams. And I know the Leader Circle helps. You know, everybody says, we can't get rid of the Leader Circle because then nobody, you know, you'd be down to 3 cars. Nobody could do it. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe all that Leader Circle money should go into the purse. I don't know. But it's all about money, and it's not going to change. And we're not going to have this big influx of new owners and new teams unless we find out a way to get some money.
Yeah, I think it's part of a puzzle that it's complicated enough to where we come up with all these simple answers. Oh, if you just did this, it would fix everything. You go, no, actually, this puzzle is so complicated that it has yet to be solved. And multiple administrations, smart people, ambitious people, dumb people, brilliant people, all kinds of people have tried to solve this, and it has yet to be solved. So it just tells me that when a problem surpasses the abilities of different regimes, different people, and still sitting there, I don't have the answer. I mean, I think we know the roots of the problem. If we had better TV ratings, we could in theory sell more advertising, sponsorship, teams would have more money. But without those bigger TV ratings, you aren't going to get more sponsorship money. Chicken or egg thing right there. Costs have been driven down in what we would think is almost every possible way. The Dallara DW12 chassis was sold for pennies compared to what an old kart or champ car chassis used to go for. Engine leases were originally really, really low. The tire bill, annual tire lease from Firestone, was originally really, really low. A couple years on, these engine lease prices are going up. The tire lease prices are going up. Prices, you know, IndyCar negotiated a parts reduction in sale percentage and whatnot, so they were able to take a little bit of money off of that, but it wasn't huge. You know, folks might remember the big spare parts prices are killing us thing that took place a couple years ago. The Leader Circle has been, you know, there's usually a little bit of money added to it each year, but it stayed somewhat stable at a little bit over $1 million per year. But even that, you know, and that, Robin, might even be worth diving into quickly because there are some who, you know, might not be fully versed in the Leader Circle. I mean, your piece about how prize money is peanuts was perfect, and it's true. It's gone from being something that drivers, crew members, I mean, when I was an IndyCar crew member, We didn't have a lot of money. A lot of the teams that I worked for in the late 90s, we had very modest budgets. So instead of negotiating a salary that was impressive, the one thing that myself and I know others did was say, okay, well, pay me this amount for an annual rate. And for the prize money, you know, because we would all get a share of the prize money, why don't we dial that up a little bit? So, you know, here's the total amount that I need to make. If you really can't afford to pay that from, you know, the annual budget the team has, then let's rely on this good prize money coming in. And that's what we did. And it was really nice getting these checks after each race for a couple grand, whatever it was. And that helped subsidize myself. And we talk about all the different mechanics and engineers and truck drivers and you name it. Well, that went away. The prize money in the IndyCar series, the IRL, was enough to where the big teams won essentially all the races and took all the prize money. And the smaller teams couldn't. And as you saw, and as we've had for a while now, the IndyCar series said, all right, well, this is a system that essentially the haves always have and the have-nots always have not. So why don't we just turn this into more of a socialized system? We're going to pool essentially almost all of the total prize money for the year and split this equally. So if you agree to show up for every race, you sign a leader circle agreement, you're going to get a check for about $1 million. And so you're not going to get much at each race. If you win the race, you get 30 grand or whatever it is, first couple of spots. But essentially, you're no longer racing for prize money. And so what happened was mechanics, engineers, you name it, prize money was more or less no longer a thing. It's no longer a profit center or a way to either add to your salary or fill in the portion of the salary your team couldn't pay for. And that became a team thing to help the team. Took drivers essentially out of the equation, took team members out of the equation. Well, the other last quick thing, Robin, which you know full well and have been hearing forever, is it was cool when teams could kind of sort of afford a year of IndyCar racing. You know, if the budget will just say it was $5 million average, most teams could afford that $5 million. They'd have that leader circle of about $1 million, maybe 1.1, 1.2, on top of that guaranteed. Well, that was a nice addition. With the hard times that IndyCar has hit financially and the glut in sponsorship income, well, if 5 million was the norm, now it's maybe they can come up with 3. And that leader circle is no longer an addition on top of the full budget they're able to find. It's actually, it's 20%, 25%, whatever it is. It's a really big slice of what they need just to get to that minimum annual budget. And that's where we are now, where you go, okay, so you get your leader circle and you're rich. And no. That's filling a big slice of the pie we can't find going to corporate America. It's a strange place we're in. I like what they were thinking with the leader circle, making sure the Dale Coins and the little teams weren't always frozen out from earning prize money. But just with the other hardships that IndyCar has faced in bringing money in and teams are able to find, this leader circle is a lifeline. And they're even struggling. A lot of teams are even struggling to pay for everything with the inclusion of the leader circle. So I don't have an answer. That was just a little bit of an explanation.
I'm always saying, too, how are we going to keep promoters? I mean, especially oval promoters. How do we keep them on the schedule? They can't. I mean, it's hard for anybody to make money when you know, whether you decide to try a street race or you're going to try an oval race, you better have a hell of a big-time title sponsor, because, you know, you just can't. It's such a tough thing to do. So maybe IndyCar has to be co-promoters or take over the race like they did at Phoenix when they first started, or last year at Watkins Glen. It's a catch-22 all the way around. It's the teams, it's the promoters, it's the drivers, it's the mechanics that don't get the percentage they used to get. The financial pyramid of IndyCar racing is upside down. That's the bottom line.
That's a good line. You should be a writer, Miller. Just consider it. Think about it. All right, so we've been the two old cranky guys up in the balcony so far. Let's try and close here in a couple minutes on a couple things that they might not be positive, but let's try and have some fun with them. So I don't know if you've printed them yet. I hope somebody has. But James Hinchcliffe's quote of, that's adorable, that needs to be a t-shirt. I absolutely love Chip Ganassi. I loved his alternative facts when asked by your colleagues and our friends at NBCSN to review the crash that involved Hinch, TK, and so many others. Chip was seeing his own alternative facts when he assigned the blame to Hinch, and then I think Aloshin and everyone but TK. I mean, look, TK has been doing this forever. He made a mistake, friends. You know, life goes on. It sucks. Again, I'm not being flippant, but all the people who said he need to retire, again, I invite you to stop following IndyCar and go do something else. But between Chip's alternative facts and Hinch's adorable comment, that at least gave me something to smile about, brother. How about you?
Well, you know, everybody in the heat of battle. I mean, Dale confronted Tony when he was sitting there in the car during the red flag. And it's just, it's racing. That tempers run high. And when big crashes happen, people lose a lot of money and people say things. And then, you know, it's everybody has a different perspective. I think Alexander Rossi was in the middle of the Ganassi sandwich, and I think he told me when I interviewed him at the hospital that he thought Dixon came up into him, but maybe he's kind of backed off that a little bit. And, you know, if Chip watched the replay and then watched and listened to Tony's comments, you know, I got into Hinch, I got to go apologize to him. It's just, it's part of, it's close quarter racing and stuff like that. Yeah, probably shouldn't be running three wide, 50 laps into a 248 lap race, but they do. That's the way it is. It's the way race drivers think. You know, people say, why don't they? Well, they don't think very well about that. Well, you know, they're in the heat of battle and they're going for it, and that's why people watch.
All right, couple quick shout outs here. You mentioned him earlier. Gabby Chavez, the Harding Racing team, didn't do anything spectacular Saturday night, but I'll tell you what, if I was running that team, that's the exact plan I would call for. All right, kid. You see any craziness in front of you? Leave them alone. You see any wacky people behind you, just, you know, an inch off your rear wheel guard? Let them go. Be smart. Be the one that gets to the finish, and they did. Finished fifth. I love that. I think just about anybody with a heart at this point has fingers crossed and is pouring holy water on their head, praying for Connor Daly to get to the finish line without a problem. And Cartoon Anvil strikes again with Takuma Sato's, you know, Takuma pulled a Sato and crashed unnecessarily, took out Dixon completely unnecessarily, and even Connor, who was just on the way to a really good finish. I don't know where he would have been, fifth, sixth, you know, something in there, but just essentially that missed all the drama and ridiculousness, and even he got tangled, you know, spun, stalled, and, you know, resumed, made the finish, but fell down a couple of positions. But I don't know. The Sato thing bummed me out because we're all hoping that the Takuma we rarely see, the one who makes wise decisions for the entire race, who we hoped was going to stick after the 500, you know, this is his first mistake after, so not to demean our reigning Indy 500 winner, but that made me sad, knowing that there are other people that were taken out in his incident, Connor as well, so maybe we need to buy Connor a beer or something.
Well, I mean, he's raced good. He's had several good races. It just, the final finish doesn't back it up, but he's really run well in the races, and I think Munoz, his teammate, had the fastest lap for a while before he got caught up in a crash, so AJ's team hadn't had a lot of luck, no doubt about it, and Connor's leading the pack. Him and Ryan Hunter-Reay, they both need to figure out something to change their luck.
Voodoo dolls. They need voodoo dolls. We have the Andretti team testing this week along with Coyne. Coyne rallying amazingly to get two cars ready to go to Elkhart Lake. Andretti was bringing up two of their lights drivers to drive for half the day. Defending Pro Mazda champion Aaron Tielitz was kind enough to point out I'm a total idiot. In the little story I wrote, I happened to mention that Andretti's Nico Jamin won the Pro Mazda championship last year, but Anyways, whoever wrote that's a complete idiot. That guy, don't even listen to what that guy says. But you got Jamin stepping up, which is good for him. You got Matthias Lice coming over from Carlin, so he was getting the invite there. And then we also have Canada's Dalton Kellett, who tested with Andretti last year at Watkins Glen. So I think Dalton's going to be close to making a move to IndyCar next year. Hopefully he does. Good to see that happening. Why don't we pause, take a second to consider this, Robin, and close on this. Dale Coyne Racing. How long ago was it where the mention of Dale Coyne Racing just involved a sneer, a shrug, those guys, some nameless driver who really didn't deserve to be in IndyCar, who paid some really small amount. This used to be the team that made up the numbers. We always liked Dale. He was always a good guy, but we always wondered, come on, man, seriously? I mean, like, you almost have to work hard to find some of the guys as anonymous as you come up with. Can we just pause for a minute to look at how far Dale Coyne Racing has come, not just on the racetrack, but in terms of love and respect by fans, media? Look at everything they've gone through. Winning this year, Seb crashing, getting hurt at Indy, Davison climbing in the car and just, going balls out and really doing amazing things there. Esteban Gutierrez coming in and that being a little spark of potential. Ed Jones just truly being a phenomenal, phenomenal driver as a rookie. Tristan Vautier going nuts last weekend, really impressing. How cool is it, Robin, to see something that, I don't know, man, I doubt you ever predicted it when Dale transitioned from driving to team ownership, and I know I never expected we'd get to a point to where not only these guys contender wherever we go, but a complete image makeover, respect for this team, and folks feeling sorry when they don't do well. I never would have fathomed.
Well, I think when Justin won for him and when Dale's first race with Bill Pappas, you thought, okay, this is the beginning. Dale's finally, no more ride by him. We're going to get serious here. Well, it took him a few years they didn't keep Justin and Bill. And I think that was the most disappointing thing. And then, a few years go by and now he's going out and getting Craig to go with Mike Cannon and Olivier and all the guys that he's hired. And I think the other thing is Dallara gets some credit for this because I think the DW12, it's such a racy car and it's given everybody's got a chance. That's what's cool about it. And wasn't that long ago when two teams or three teams at the most won every race. And now, you got Coyne and Smith Peterson and Ray Hall, Lanigan, and Letterman. And so I think Coyne is probably. I think with Dale, maybe he's made money. Maybe he's the one owner that's made money out of IndyCar racing in the last 25 years. I hope so. But I think he's a serious racer now. And I think, when you take a hit like he did and you can see how many people rode in and felt, they feel bad for him, he's kind of become, somebody came up to me and said, oh, you guys keep writing about little guys, Coyne ain't a little guy, he's just like the rest of us. Well, he's still a little guy in terms of, he's never had Target or Verizon or a big, God knows how much those people spend, he's never had that, and so he still is a little guy, and they're a little shop in Plainfield, Illinois, but I think the respect factor is there, and I think it's kind of cool to see because I don't think you see too many small teams in Formula One or even in NASCAR being able to do what they can.
Amen to that. All right, Robin. Well, we've yapped enough for this week. I'm headed out to Charlotte to, we'll cut 30 minutes out of it, but I'm headed off to Charlotte for the weekend for some Le Mans fun with my friends, our old friends. I'll be heading back to our old home base at the former Speed, which is now just the Fox Sports home in Charlotte. But I'll be heading there this weekend. We'll have a couple of our IndyCar driver friends, Dixie, TK, Mikhail, Townie Bell and whatnot, who are competing in France, the 24-hour. And I'm sure we'll have some other fun stuff to cover next week in the Week in IndyCar News.
Well, just remember, when you're on TV, you can't cuss. Even though some of it's cable. Fox and Fox Sports 1, buddy. I got confidence in you.